From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, a new business incubator is going up on Prospect.
We need a beacon of urban development. We need something that really grabs their attention.
Kansas Cityans react to an attack on our vegetarian options. Plus, with the release of George Lucas's Red Tails, hear from a local Tuskegee Airman.
And with the recent shuttering of Jardine's, local jazz aficionados talk about where the future of jazz in Kansas City is.
The Kansas City jazz scene is going through this transition in terms of its audience. A younger, more open-minded audience is being developed, while the older audience is naturally going away.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. The Community Development Corporation, Blue Hills Community Services, has been helping rebuild the Blue Hills neighborhood for the past 35 years. And they've just begun construction on their latest project, an energy-efficient renovation of a building at 50th and Prospect that will help build the capacity of small-time contractors they've been working with all along. As Sylvia reports, this contractor's incubator will be the first of its kind in the Kansas City area.
Cliff Popert is Director of Planning and Development at Blue Hills Community Services. He works directly with many contractors to rehab and build new homes in the neighborhood.
A lot of the contractors we work with, they're pretty small shops. They're the owners of their business, but they're also the daily laborers of their business. They don't really have the professional staff to be able to perform some of the office duties. So sometimes their family members will be doubling that role. Sometimes they'll be performing that role from their truck.
That makes it difficult for these contractors to meet with clients. And without a computer, they write out most of their invoices and bids longhand. Blue Hills Executive Director Joanne Businger says that over the years, the organization has been working one-on-one with contractors to improve their capacity.
So we may start them out with a small project, a concrete project, or a water heater project at one of our multifamily properties. And then as they increase their business and are able to afford additional insurance as required by federally funded projects, then we can move them into and give them bidding opportunities for other construction projects, larger projects, like single-family renovation or home repair services.
And what kind of contractors are we talking about? What do they do?
Some of them do just very trade-specific, like heating and cooling, concrete work. And then we have a few contractors that we've been able to work with that can do complete home renovations or portions, major portions of home renovation.
I sat down with Joanne Businger in her office a few days ago to talk about how this idea of an incubator will address the needs of some of these small business owners.
The contractor incubator will provide very low-cost office space that is furnished with a desk, a chair, computer, access to copier equipment, conference room, and what it does is it allows them to do their business in a more professional way. Instead of doing it out of their truck at the job site, they can come to the office, they can perform their professional duties, they have access to equipment that they may not otherwise have. We'll be able to give them training on business acumen, such as estimating software or computer software. Will be able to improve their trade-specific issues like lead-based paint, asbestos abatement, Section 3 certification, which is disadvantaged contractors, and their MBE-WBE certifications.
Which is the minority business owners, women business owners.
Correct.
Have you heard contractors or some construction companies having trouble finding enough businesses that are owned by women or led by minorities here in Kansas City?
There are often a lot of businesses that are eligible, but if they don't have some of those certifications through the City of Kansas City, Missouri, they're not always eligible to bid on city and federally funded projects that are endorsed by the city. So They may be a minority contractor, but they need to be certified through the city to work on these projects.
How much interest is there among contractors to set up offices there?
Well, we have 10 to 12 offices that will be available, and we have more letters of interest than we will have offices. So we'll have to prioritize that in some way, but definitely we're going to focus on the contractor that needs to build their capacity. You know, this is kind of a startup for them. So they won't be able to stay there indefinitely. They'll be able to increase their capacity, grow their business, and hopefully then they'll be able to go to other office space.
And will they pay some kind of rent?
There is very low cost rent. It's less than $2 a square foot. The value to them will be in the training and how they connect with other contractors and regional contractors to increase their business opportunities.
And you've also heard from regional contractors that they're interested in offering these training sessions.
Right. We've talked with a lot of the larger local regional contractors. They are very excited about this opportunity. They have to meet participation goals as well. So if they can increase the pool of contractors that are available that are certified, certainly they're very excited. Not only that, but MCC, Full Employment Council, those groups have capacity to help us provide some of these trainings.
MCC being Metropolitan Community Colleges.
Correct.
Now, the Green Impact Zone, which the Blue Hills neighborhood is in, is this program that's concentrating federal stimulus funding to make significant changes in 150 square block area of East Kansas City. I wonder, where does your new business incubator fit in?
That's our goal, is to be able to increase the number of construction jobs available so that we can create jobs in the neighborhood and create demand within the Green Impact Zone.
One of the challenges that they've faced is not hiring many local people to do the work, or maybe not finding enough local people to do the work.
Right. Absolutely.
And when did you realize that this was an idea that you could get support for?
We owned the building since 2006, and we had a different multifamily use for the building, and we weren't able to secure the financing for that particular project because of the location to Bruce R. Watkins. So we started about 2 years ago really imagining what we could do with a site that is so prominent at 50th and Prospect and so visible from Bruce R. Watkins. Over 95,000 commuters have visibility to this site off of Bruce R. Watkins, 95,000 people. So we started thinking we need a beacon of urban development. We need something that really grabs their attention and something that is needed in the neighborhood. And that's just transforming Prospect Corridor. So we really started working with the architect and kind of dreaming this design of a beacon of hope for the neighborhood, something that is like a gateway to the community. And so we're real excited that this is going to happen. After 2 years, we're really excited that it's going to finally happen.
I understand that you have a very green design for this building.
This is 14,000 square foot building on 4 acres. It will be a complete energy efficient renovation. We're shooting for a minimum LEED Silver standard, which really makes the facility more efficient, it more environmentally sustainable, you know, reduces our local energy consumption. It will be a very green building.
It is an area that has a fair number of boarded up stores and empty lots. I wonder if you can talk about the building you're planning and how it will fit in that landscape there at 50th and Prospect.
There is an incredible amount of vacant property, vacant land in this general vicinity, but there are strong local businesses along the corridor as well. And so this project will begin that transformation of the Prospect Corridor, will begin to give hope to some of those businesses and hopefully encourage future development and future businesses. One of the things we would like to do is develop or work with the businesses in the area to develop a business association. And we're working right now on evaluating the demand for a community improvement district, which would provide resources so that we can start addressing some of the issues along the corridor, such as trash pickup, graffiti abatement, and so forth.
Are there other plans for development along that corridor, the Prospect Corridor?
There is a grocery store, and then the new Kansas City Police Lab, Crime Lab, is planned for north of 50th and Prospect. There are many development opportunities south of that area to 63rd Street, and this will really connect or bridge the development that we've been doing in the interior of the neighborhood with our single-family new construction and acquisition rehab, and then we have two major minor home repair programs that work with owner-occupied residents to improve their home.
Joanne Boosinger is Executive Director of Blue Hills Community Services. Thanks so much for joining us on KC Currents.
Thank you so much.
The new Blue Hills Community Services Center and Contractor Incubator is slated to open this fall. It's being financed through Kansas City's Energy Works KC grant from the Department of Energy and funding from Housing and Urban Development and Greater Kansas City LISC. There'll be a community meeting about the project at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library on Wednesday at 5:30. A recent New York Times article rankled Kansas City foodies by suggesting that it's tough to be a vegetarian here in the heart of barbecue country, and even worse in rural parts of the Midwest. So Harvest Public Media's Jessica Najunas, who lives in Columbia, Missouri, looked into it in her latest episode of Field Notes.
Field Notes has been around for almost a year. And in that time, I've visited dozens and dozens of farmers, stared dairy cows in the eye, and sat on the floor next to hungry sows. But I've never let you know that even though I'm a food and agriculture reporter, I'm also a vegetarian. That's why when New York Times reporter A.G. Sulzberger wrote an article with this recent headline, Meatless in the Midwest, A Tale of Survival, I laughed. In the piece, Sulzberger asserts the Midwest is a place where the most common vegetable you'll see on dinner plates is iceberg lettuce. As I read this article on my phone, actually sitting in a supermarket, surrounded by fresh food in my brown paper bags, I was perplexed by some of Sulzberger's claims. And I found I wasn't alone.
You know, the New York Times is a great newspaper. I mean, I like the newspaper. I read it almost every day.
Emmanuel Cleaver, a congressman from Missouri's 5th District, weighed in at the Missouri Governor's Conference on Agriculture in Kansas City on Friday.
If you don't know Kansas City or St. Louis or Missouri, you know, maybe you ought to write about Broadway, because we have a farmer's market here in Kansas City that is in the city charter.
Cleaver says to close the city market, local government would have to hold a full-fledged election. That market stays open, and it's often the centerpiece of the Kansas City food scene. Lots of fresh food there.
You can go down to the city market this weekend and buy fresh fruit, and there are urban gardens all around. Should we have more supermarkets with fresh fruits and vegetables? Absolutely. We do have food deserts, mainly in the predominantly Hispanic and African American areas, and we do need to do something about that. But I'm not ready to start agreeing with anybody who says, that you can't get fruit and vegetables in this community. That's just not accurate.
Cleaver's on to something. And yes, there might be some truth to the idea that in Kansas City, there's a dearth of good eating. But you're not likely to find it in the vegetarian world. In Jackson County, 18.4% of families aren't able to put full meals on the dinner table. That's more than Chicago, New York City, and Los Angeles. In the Midwest, as a privileged ag reporter, I've never gone hungry for fresh food or for a good farming story. It's also been a breeze to find Midwestern consumers who love to talk about the things they find to eat here. We asked Sulzberger to chat with us about his opinions, but he declined. It would be easy to go line by line through Sulzberger's article and fact-check his iceberg lettuce manifesto while he's not in the room. Instead, I give you my vegetarian rules for eating well in the Midwest. Rule number one, learn to cook at home.
First things first, I think it was pretty obvious that he was just trying to be a sensationalist. So job well done for him.
Annie Corrigan is the host and producer of Earth Eats, public radio's popular show about food. It's based in, the Midwest in Bloomington, Indiana. The New York Times reporter in question visited barbecue restaurants and other eateries that clearly lack options for vegetarians. I call that culinary entrapment.
It feels like another example of someone who's associated with the coast trying to talk about the Midwest like they know, They have no idea what our lives are actually like. So that was the main crux of my peevishness. But the annoyance that I had about what he was saying about food is, you know, big and different from that.
Annie Corrigan says she can always find fresh produce in the Midwest and places to eat it, too. Usually, she likes to call this place the kitchen.
I have no patience for an argument that isn't based in reality. Of course, if you're going to go to a barbecue joint, you're probably not going to find veggies. That's not going to be the top thing on the menu. Of course not. But if you're seeking out things to cook in your own kitchen, it's really not hard to find. Cooking in your kitchen is the best way to eat well.
In the Midwest, it's really no different than the coasts. We want fresh, healthy food when we can afford it. Though around here, we're known for barbecue and steaks. And New York is known for pizza, cheesecake, bagels, lamb over rice carts. Both cities obviously have a lot more going for them. Here's the difference. The Kansas City area grows a lot of food. A lot of food that stays close to home. And a lot of it is shipped out, too. Last year, area farmers exported over $1 billion in crops. Over 66% of the state's total land use is for farming. There are dozens of farmers markets here. There are many producers. Many of them don't grow iceberg lettuce. So rule number one, if you're unhappy with the myriad vegetarian options in Kansas City, eat the food grown here at home and grow hungry no more. That brings me to rule number two, explore.
Well, my name is Matt Iman. I'm the community manager for Yelp here in Kansas City.
He said he first saw the Sulzberger piece on a Yelp discussion board.
The reactions ranged from, you know, amusement to insult.
The gist of the article to him didn't seem accurate.
You know, Yelp users are interested in painting an accurate picture of a city that they're, you know, by and large, a big fan of.
And these Yelp users have helped create a database of helpful vegetarian tips in Kansas City.
You know, all you need to do is click in vegetarian at the top.
And you come up with 14 different Kansas City restaurants that offer vegetarian options.
Recently, I had the pleasure of going to Nika's 320 on the Crossroads, and they have a plethora of vegetarian options, you know, ranging from fully customizable macaroni and cheese to maybe my new favorite sandwich in the city called the Mad Hatter, which has portobello mushrooms, a strawberry balsamic, you know, with onions, figs, spinach, and a dill Havarti cheese.
This vegetarian would not turn her nose up at that sandwich. And if you're on the road in the Midwest, rule number two, explore, applies too.
If you go into it and you place, you find out what's unique about it or what's cool about it, not what the stereotypes are, and try and reinforce those stereotypes.
That's Jim Cosgrove.
I'm from Kansas City, and I'm a musician, and my wife and I are vegetarians, and we manage to stay healthy and well-fed.
Jim's on the road a lot for his music, and that means he runs into small towns with little to offer in the way of varied vegetarian options. He recalls a visit to Iowa, where, no surprise, the vegetable of the day at a particular eatery was corn.
We just asked the waitress and said, hey, do you have anything green back in the cooler? Anything? She said, you know, I think there's some broccoli.
The waitress steamed the broccoli and paired it for them with some rice. There was no fuss and no confusion.
You know, sometimes you got to ask, too, and people will, you know, accommodate some easier than others. But certainly in city centers, you're going to find it is not even that hard anymore.
Rule number two, explore just a little bit and be willing to get creative in the process. The last part, and this might be merely a lesson in cultural acceptance, keep an open mind. That's my third vegetarian rule for eating well in the Midwest. And think of it this way. Finding something good to eat can be hard for both vegetarians and carnivores alike, at home and abroad. Trying times in my life as a vegetarian occurred in Paris, France, the boot heel of Missouri, and a tiny Greek island off the coast of Turkey. In those exotic locales, I took the meat minefield as a challenge. I got to know the locals and indulged in the humor in dodging foie gras, beef jerky, and souvlaki.
That was Harvest Public Media's Jessica Najunas. Find more stories about food and agriculture on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
Coming up, a new film tells the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. Hear from one of them with close ties to Kansas City. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
We want to follow up on a few stories we've aired in the past couple of months. On January 8th, I interviewed an Overland Park psychologist who works with the victims of priest sexual abuse. We talked about children and the problems they can carry into adulthood. And in part of the interview, we spoke specifically about boys.
One listener wrote, "Girls have also been victims. We have the, quote, survivor guilt, along with the added burden that people think, quote, girls asked for it. Fast forward several decades when people actually believe priests may have misbehaved and then notice that it is only male victims that make the news."
On a lighter note, you may remember Jeremiah Baer, better known as
King Edward Jeremiah Plantagenet.
We featured Baer in a story back in October. He was just finishing the summer season as king at the Kansas City Renaissance Festival. He told us what it's like to play king and about his life outside of the Renaissance Festival.
I'm an art teacher. I do graphic design, digital photography. I'd say one of my passions, however, is actually sculpture. And my favorite medium is actually Legos.
That passion has just paid off in a big way. Baer recently won the title of Lego Master Model Builder at the soon-to-come Legoland at Crown Center. We caught up with him over the phone to find out about his latest accomplishment. With the new job, Baer says he'll be responsible for building and maintaining new models and exhibits within Legoland. He'll also be teaching Master Model Builder classes and taking part in youth outreach. But with this new position, he says he'll likely have to hang up his Renaissance Festival crown.
It's very, very bittersweet. The position of king is something that takes a lot of extra time and dedication. At this point, I don't know for sure if I would be able to commit to that. This new opportunity is my ultimate dream job. It's a combination of my passions of working with children and youth and also my passion for the Lego brick.
Baer said that his last appearance as king could be at this year's St. Patrick's Day parade. He starts his new job as Master Model Lego Builder in February.
George Lucas's much-anticipated World War II film Red Tails opens this weekend. It tells the story of the all-black 332nd Fighter Group and the 447th Bombardment Group of the U.S. Air Force, better known as the Tuskegee Airmen, the first African-American military pilots. Former Kansas City resident Colonel Charles McGee was part of this pioneering group. He flew many dangerous missions as a fighter pilot in World War II, and then later in the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Colonel McGee eventually went on to serve as base commander at the Richards Gabar Air Force Base and director of the Kansas City Downtown Airport. Susan caught up with Charles McGee back in 2010 at the Kansas City Public Library.
Well, I'm not one of those that aspired from a little kid seeing an airplane fly over to get into flying. I was interested in engineering and learned of the experiment that was going to take place because the Army had said that they couldn't use black pilots until they had black mechanics. And so when that first squadron was approved, the mechanics training took place at Chanute Field in Rantoul, Illinois. And that was just a few miles away from where I was in school and college. So I went and signed up and passed the exams for pilot training and was accepted, so I entered as a cadet.
From there, what was the process of forming the Tuskegee Airmen?
Well, there had been the usual battle for inclusion and opportunity because the Army policy was exclusion of blacks in a technical area. They didn't mind if we built roads, swept the streets, cooked food, drove vehicles, but they didn't think we had the capability in a technical area. So this experiment, they expected it to fail, but it turned out differently than that because after they allowed the training, they found that we could perform as well as others. From that beginning, the program produced four single-engine fighter squadrons with their support and four medium bomber squadrons with their support.
When you took your first few flights, what was it like? Did you have any difficulties at first?
Well, not difficulties. I can recall that first flight, the instructor said, "You can see over there where they're building the airfield." I probably said yes, but I'm not sure what I saw, but it was a great thrill for me, and I put it that I really fell in love with flying after that first flight, to realize that you can loop, roll, and spin, and climb to altitude and not have to have a foot on the ground. It's a real thrill.
You had a particular plane, and you gave that plane a name.
Oh, yeah, we were allowed to do that, and my wife's nickname was Kitten, so I put Kitten on the plane, and then I told him, well, put it on both sides, because my crew chief was keeping that engine purring like a kitten. And so I thought that was very, very, very fitting.
What was your scariest mission where you had really close call?
Well, I guess you could say one. I did have one victory over Pardubice Aerodrome in Yugoslavia, and that gets rather interesting because you know somebody up there is trying to get you in their gun sights and try to close in on the altitude that we were flying and fire their anti-aircraft guns. So it makes you realize that you're there to fire back at them, but they're also there trying to stop you from performing.
Now, you say interesting. Some would say terrifying.
Well, I have always kind of felt situations get your adrenaline up, but you can't be fearful because that way your thinking is wrong. You got to think positive and so on. So, but training really prepared us for the task, and so I didn't see it quite as terror. We were pretty well prepared for what we were facing.
How were your fellow airmen treated? Because you said the thought was that this experiment was going to fail. So I can imagine you still faced some discrimination, some ways of being treated back then that weren't particularly good.
Well, that's true, because of the Army policy, they carried the segregation overseas. In other words, we were not stationed with white pilots or at the same base that other white units were. Okay, we had our own support, we had our own base, so we operated completely separate, and many of the bomber pilots, too well after the war, did not know that the Red Tails were black pilots. We still face that coming home, coming down the ramp off the boat. They still had the signs, blacks this way, whites that way. Segregation in the Army had not, even though we performed successfully, had not changed their policy, and segregation existed overseas, and so it wasn't until later that when the Air Force became a separate service and well after the war years that the real change in, if you will, equal access and equal opportunity began to take place within the military structure. Realizing that I might like to be a commercial pilot, they weren't ready, so I stayed in the military. It wasn't until in the early 60s that after a couple of lawsuits that blacks were began to be hired commercial aviation arena.
Well, you know, even now, you don't see a lot of black pilots in commercial airlines. Do you keep up with what's going on there in terms of pilots?
Well, we try to. One of the charters, if you will, of our national organization, Tuskegee Airmen, is motivate our young people, because there's still opportunities there, many, not just the pilots, but maintaining aircraft and all that type of other opportunities, and youngsters need to prepare themselves for those opportunities. And yes, you're right, if we don't get them interested early, then the pipeline dries up, and pretty soon we realize that there ought to be more participating, and that opportunity is there, but you still have to prepare yourself. So it pushes that we need to talk about education and preparation, and certainly our experience has values that we hope are meaningful to those young folks.
Now, do you keep in touch with your other Tuskegee Airmen?
Fairly much. We organized nationally in 1972, and Unfortunately, I've only missed a couple of annual conventions since that time, so many became very close friends, certainly out of the years 41 to 49 when we were all we trained together overseas back into the States, and together until that time frame, we did develop lifelong friends.
That was Colonel Charles McGee, former president of the Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated. Colonel McGee lived in Kansas City and was base commander at the Richards Gebauer Air Force Base and director of the downtown airport. We spoke to him in 2010.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. About half of the year, you'll find artist Wilbert Niewald painting a stand of trees in Luce Park, or the freeway circling around buildings in the West Bottoms. Or he'll be in his studio painting a cluster of apples in a pitcher, or his wife of more than 60 years, Jerry. A new exhibition at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art focuses on Niewald's portraits painted over the last 40 years. KCUR's Laura Spencer talked to the artist in his West Bottoms studio.
I don't consider myself a portrait painter or a landscape painter or a still life painter. All of it to me is one. It's all painting. And once I began to paint directly, which was about 1970, I naturally moved right away into landscape and then, you know, naturally still life, and then decided, of course, I would do figures.
Well, could you talk about that moment you talked about in the early 70s when you, mm-hmm. you described it different ways, but as sort of that kind of transformation moment when you decided to change your style?
Through the 50s and the 60s, I was painting abstractly, but my painting continually evolved into what could be called, which was, in a way, representation. I was pleased with what was going on. We were in Mexico, and I was painting indirectly by making drawings and then coming into the studio and working from those drawings in a painting. And we came home. I was back in the studio at home. I sort of asked myself, why am I painting indirectly? Why don't I just look out the window and paint what I see? And it was one of the most liberating, freeing experiences of my life. Opened up a whole new world, a world that I knew through my teaching and what I knew many years earlier. So from that moment on, it was always direct painting from nature, and in this context, I'm using nature as all that we see.
One thing Alice Thorson from The Star suggested, people know you from your landscapes of Penn Valley and Luce Park, and in your portraits, you are painting often, you're painting yourself or your wife or your daughter, but there's a somewhat of a repetition of figures, and she suggested that you have to have kind of an intimacy with your subjects in the same way that you have with the landscape. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, if you find that you kind of need to have that connection to your subject.
I would say that all of it was a study. In other words, I don't consider so much, I know sometimes one hears, just that you have to know the person and all of this to really express what's there. But for me, what's there is what I see. I'm not trying to get a likeness. The likeness that I want is the likeness of the relationships of color, because that's what we see. And if I get that, then I know that someone will, I hope that someone will say, yes, that looks like or feels like that person. But it's basically, to me, or it's no different than painting anything else. It's just as difficult to paint an apple as it is a face, except for this thing, that the subtlest little change people would notice more in a portrait than you would the apple. But basically, it's all still life. If you're painting from observation, it's all still life.
Well, I'm curious about your self-portraits because you are working from direct observation. How do you paint yourself?
Well, I just have my an easel with a mirror, and I set that up, and then my painting and canvas, you know, very close, and then just start in. It's just a study. It's a wonderful thing to do, just to study the relationships and the emotion, the feelings. That's all in what you see. It's not in trying to impose anything. Giacometti said a wonderful thing. He said, first of all painting is subjective. And you don't try to express yourself. It just is there, whatever you're doing. And he used this term. He said, copy the cup. Copy the cup, but it's always your cup. And that's the same way I feel. I just say, copy what I see, but it's all within myself.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Laura.
Wilbur Niewald, The Studio Portrait, an exhibition featuring 14 portraits, continues at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art through June 17th. More information and photos can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
After the break, local jazz musicians and critics talk about where it's at and where it's not in KC's jazz scene. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas City took another step towards streetcars downtown. It was back to the drawing board on Missouri's congressional redistricting, and Missouri's governor proposed another big cut to state university budgets. Steve Bell reviews those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon spoke of spending more on K-12 education in his State of the State address. But overall, his budget was about not spending $508 million in cuts, including more than $100 million trimmed from higher education.
I'm calling on our colleges and universities to continue to look for more ways to cut overhead and administrative costs and run smarter, more efficient operations.
Senate President Pro Tem Rob Mayer said on top of a 5% cut to higher ed last year and $17 million this year, it was a hard hit.
It's about 12.5%, which is a very significant reduction to a budget that's already tight.
House Republicans, like the Democratic governor, were also talking about not spending. They passed a proposal for a constitutional amendment that would limit future spending increases to inflation and population growth margins. Democrats like Jeanette Mott Oxford of St. Louis said the spending cap is a dangerous move that would make it hard for lawmakers to address new needs that emerge in the future.
When we try, through constantly amending our Constitution, to figure out how to solve future problems that we can't see right now, we wind up creating these unintended consequences that are truly bad for our state.
The spending limit amendment would still have to pass the Senate and a public vote. Kansas City, Missouri was also looking at more cuts. City Manager Troy Schulte's budget proposal would react to still lagging revenues by ending curbside yard waste collection, tightening up on street repairs and parks maintenance, and eliminating 105 fire department positions. Schulte said that was possible because the number of fires is down, but Fire Chief Smokey Dyer said it would drastically change the way his people handle the fires that do occur.
If you do not have some type of positive indicator that there's a human in the structure, then the standard is that you do not enter the structure if you have three people on the scene.
The Firefighters Union called Schulte's proposed cuts a contract negotiation ploy. In Kansas, Reagan administration economist Arthur Laffer promoted the tax plan he engineered for Governor Sam Brownback. Laffer said reducing income tax rates will help everyone in Kansas because it'll build prosperity.
People will always try to avoid a taxed activity, and the income tax is a negative incentive.
Critics were still ranting about Brownback plans to eliminate the home mortgage interest deduction and earned income tax credit and to keep the state's temporary sales tax increase. Late in the week, Republican leaders in the legislature proposed their own tax plan, commenting that Brownback's had little chance of passing. The Kansas City City Council proposed a transportation development district from the River Market to Union Station and Crown Center to create an operating funds taxation base for a downtown streetcar system. Councilman Russ Johnson said acting now is based on advice from Washington.
We had to make a decision whether to pursue the Tiger funds this year or we were going to punt and hope to get the ball back later.
The plan would have to be approved by voters in the transportation district. And the Missouri Supreme Court struck down the state's new congressional redistricting plan on a technicality and questioned the constitutionality of the boundaries of two of the plan's districts, including the one served by Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. This is KCUR.
The past few months have been rough for local jazz. Two promising newer venues, 1911 Main and Cafe Augusta in Lenexa, have shut down. And at Jardine's, one of the city's most celebrated venues, a dispute between the owner and employees led to a boycott by musicians. The restaurant then closed its doors, and its future remains up in the air.
Restaurants and bars in Kansas City come and go all the time, but what's the significance when a dedicated jazz venue closes down? What does it take to have a successful jazz venue? And what should artists do to keep the scene vibrant? This week, the KC Current staff teamed up to ask some of the city's best-known musicians and music writers these questions. Here's what they said.
My name is Mark Lowry. I'm a pianist from Kansas City, Missouri. I grew up north of the river, and I used to, when I finally got my car, I went down to the Majestic Steakhouse to go listen to Joe Cartwright, you know, and drink coffee and eat cheesecake and feel cultured, and I'd listen to these great musicians and then go home and practice, because after hearing these guys, you really have to. And so I would just try to learn more and more about the different places in town, the 18th and Vine District, the Phoenix, and Jardines. You know, I really felt comfortable and at home at Jardines. It was a fantastic stage and a great piano and good people. I used to go there to practice when I was in high school, you know, after I got out of school. So I always had the most fantastic piano of any club in town outside of, you know, UMKC or the concert halls at the Folly. I would just go down and hey, do you mind? And, you know, the owner would be like, well, all right, you know, and I just kind of just hammer a few things out and just, you know, it was kind of, in some ways, as a child, still a child, it was kind of a fantasy. You know, I always got to practice at the jazz club, and it was always my goal. It's like, one day I'll play here on a Saturday night, you know. And, you know, a few years later, you know. I think that, you know, maybe we're talking about a little more than a decade ago where the Plaza was more of a place to be than it is now. There wasn't as much in Kansas City, so geographically it made sense. From my perspective, just having a good stage, good lights, and a good piano. As a piano player, a really high-quality piano in a jazz club is not the most common of things. So that's what I personally gravitated towards. The situation at that club is complicated, and even I don't know all the pieces. I wasn't a business partner. I was really an employee, a musician employee, that was very close friends with other employees, and what I've really come to love about Kansas City the more I travel is that we have a wealth of common decency and manners towards each other in a lot of respects. And when I saw that more and more wasn't happening, and kind of an explosion of a lot of unfortunate business decisions that affected close friends of mine, I just had to walk away.
My name is Bill Brownlee. I'm a freelance writer and author of PlasticSax.com, a blog about Kansas City jazz. The shuttering of Jardines is particularly unfortunate for the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are unwilling to go to the city's best jazz club, the Blue Room, because of its location. There's still a terrible misperception that the jazz district isn't safe. I know dozens of people who call themselves jazz fans who have never been to the Blue Room. Jardines was a wonderful club, and most everything about it was good, but it was the safe, traditional place to go hear jazz. Now, with the Blue Room accepted, people who want to hear jazz will have to work a little bit harder to find it. The Kansas City jazz scene is going through this transition in terms of its audience. A younger, more open-minded audience is being developed, while the older audience, the people who remember a time when jazz actually was popular music, is naturally going away. This transition makes it difficult for a club like Jardine's or 1911 Main to stay open. Yet, there's an opportunity for a club that is willing to cater to people in their 20s and 30s to thrive if they book jazz musicians with an interest in hip-hop and R&B and rock music as well. It's difficult to get a skinny jeans wearing 20-something into a upscale dinner club that features jazz like the Majestic coming back on a regular basis. Clubs like the Record Bar, where people are allowed to stand, walk around, eat pizza, I think that's the future of jazz venues.
My name is Herman Mahari, and I'm a trumpet player. I play mainly with a group called Diverse. The troubles at Jardine's really might have been significant to a lot of people. Not really to me, because I didn't really play there enough for it to be an economical problem for myself. And I kind of made sure, like, that was so, because in my vision and my career, yes, I do want to play in Kansas City. Yes, I do enjoy Kansas City, but if my livelihood is dependent on one club, or like significantly dependent on one club, I think that speaks for like my career in a sense. I think from the artist side, not having concern for the audience. I don't think you have to sacrifice your art to be concerned about the audience. But if you purposefully don't care what the audience thinks, well, they're probably not going to really care what you think, you know? And I think, so artists kind of need to lose that self-entitlement. Oh, I've put so many hours in the practice room. People need to hear me. Or, you know, I think people got to realize that, you know, in order to be a successful musician, and if you want to make money doing it, you got to make money doing it, and it's not going to just happen because, you know, you play great here locally. That has to be a given. You know, playing great has to be a given. You know, the question is, what more can you do to make a successful business out of yourself?
My name's Larry Kopitnik. A couple years ago, I guess it's been about 2.5 years ago now, started a blog. The marketing end is where I see most of these establishments at their weakest. There are a certain number of people who will come because it's jazz, but first and foremost, the place is a restaurant or bar. That's how it makes its money, and it needs to sell that experience and excel at that experience to get an audience to come back and come for the music as well. 1911 Main came and went fairly quickly as a jazz establishment. And I think there were a lot of reasons for that. But part of it was because few people, for most of the time they were in existence, knew they were there. They bought ads in a publication that didn't really reach the demographic who was going to come out and hear their music. Jardine's, on the other hand, and of course, they're not closed because they weren't drawing people. They're closed because musicians are boycotting them. But Jardine's had an excellent online calendar. They did a good job of sending out emails. They did a good job of building a mail list and reaching out to the people who were interested in the music and interested in coming there. They had a solid social media presence on Facebook. They did a good job of reaching the audience, and the audience came. The Blue Room is doing an excellent job of marketing these days. They brought in a new marketing director who's really utilizing social media, reaching out on Facebook, building a list, sending out emails regularly, doing a good job of reaching a broader demographic, really promoting the big events that they have there and the big names that they have there better than the Blue Room has promoted in the past.
My name is Tim Whitmer. Well, I think what is working in the jazz environment is clubs like the Phoenix,
Phoenix is a tremendous amount of fun. It's got an excellent staff. They support the music. They listen to the music. There's and it's set up to hear good music. I think places like the Blue Room, set up to listen to music, has world-class music. You know, I think we're at a really significant point right now with openings of cultural institutions like the Kauffman Center. There are more and more big acts, Sprint Center, coming to town, and I think there'll be offshoots of different clubs. I look for clubs to build up around the Kauffman Center area. I look for more clubs in the Crossroads. I look for the West Bottoms. I think more of the restaurants like the Cursos that are deciding that they love to have this kind of music, and they're seeing how well it works. I think it's going to be a really positive time.
Probably most importantly, a listening audience, an audience that has came there to listen. Some places are not conducive for me to play around town because they don't listen. And if I'm hired to write some background music, that's one thing, but I don't really play background music per se. Then you have the staff and management. Management sets the tone of how the staff is going to respond at the door, behind the bar, or your servers. Management sets the tone in terms of the policy toward musicians. Is there a musician's menu? Or can you order off the regular menu at a discount? Can you start a tab? Things like this mean a lot, you know. Not that you're going to try to drink them dry, but it's nice to know that, you know, you can have a few drinks during the night. At the same token, the musicians need to have their etiquette together to know how to tip and compensate the people who serve them. Because at the same time, you need the whole picture to make an event. You need the musicians, you need the wait staff, you need the bartender, and you need a good manager who knows who to hire. Give everybody a chance. You know, I think everybody deserves a chance to fail. You know, so if you give somebody a gig and they don't draw anybody, what's the incentive for the manager to bring you back? You know, that's the reality of this business, you know. It's about getting butts in the seat and building a following. So if the artist gets a chance, and a good manager will give somebody a chance, and a good manager will give somebody they believe in several chances, because it takes time to build up a following, especially new up-and-coming artists. You know, the more established artists here in town, they have a responsibility to upgrade their repertoire over the years. I think the problem, but a lot of the artists is that they need to work on their repertoire. You know, you go to see them and year after year, decade after decade, they're playing the same stuff, you know? And if you can imagine working with these guys or girls or whatever, it's got to be, you know, the thrill is gone. You're going through the motions. I'm sorry. They need to work on their repertoire and bring new material to the stage, you know? It's not that hard to learn a new song and work it out, you know? I don't care how big of a fan you are of an artist. You want to hear them stretch out and try to do something new. And I think that's a big problem here in Kansas City.
That was alto saxophonist, composer, and UMKC professor Bobby Watson. We also spoke to pianist Mark Lowry, plastic sax blogger Bill Brownlee, trumpet player Herman Mahari, KC Jazzlark blogger Larry Kapitnik, and pianist and bandleader Tim Whitmer. Our story was produced by Alex Smith.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan is our intern. Our theme music is by Approach. And as always, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.